Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Good. Okay. So thanks for having me here today. Again, my name is Michael Brennan. I work for an organization called Second Muse. And the title of my talk today is called Building Internet Freedom Tools for Real People. Now, I've spoken at Congress a few times before, but about a more specific topic based on my authorship recognition research on how authorship recognition can be an important issue for privacy and security. And I did my academic research around that. And now that I'm done with academia, I wanted to take kind of some of the work that I was doing there and start looking at how it can be applied more broadly. How can we build more effective tools that could be used by individuals all around the world trying to circumvent censorship, surveillance, communicate safely, communicate anonymously? So I want to start by telling a little story, and that's about my time last December in Burma. I had the really amazing privilege, and I consider it a privilege, and I thank the folks that brought me there, to go to Burma with an organization called Radio Free Asia. Radio Free Asia is a nonprofit based in the United States that promotes free press and free speech in countries in Asia where those things are not necessarily a given right. And in our time there, I was there with a number of technologists and diplomats and other folks. We tried to spend some time understanding the state of information and communication technology infrastructure throughout the country, the state of censorship in the country, the state of access to the internet. And to give you a sense, and now the country, Burma is changing a lot right now, and this was a year ago, so I'm not gonna suggest that everything is the same now as it was a year ago. But for the purpose of this story, I think you can get a good sense of what all this stuff was by looking at this photo. This is a photo of a giant mural in the information ministry of the Burmese government. I don't want to try and take away from it by trying to explain it too much, but Yadamarpan Teleport, which is the building in the background, is a state-owned telecom, and you can see the mixture of emotions and craziness, I think, that goes on. Just this is a giant mural that goes on a huge wall in the information ministry. So here's some facts about Burma in December of 2012. Number one, if you wanted a SIM card for your phone to access a mobile data plan, you needed an official ID, you needed two passport photos, and you had to fill out a whole bunch of paperwork and submit it to the government to get approved by a plan. Oh, and the plan costs $250, which is multiple times the monthly income of your average Burmese family. If you wanted to go access the internet in an internet cafe, the rules around that included the cafe had to record the identities of all users, and it'd take screenshots of every screen every 5 minutes. And it restricted access to political websites. And finally, a law that was still in the books, though perhaps not being enforced at this time, was that sending or receiving material over the internet that the government found offensive was punishable by long jail terms. And we actually met an activist blogger who spent served 4 years of a 20-year jail term for receiving an email with a cartoon that offended the government. Receiving an email, not sending. So all this in a place where, at the same time, access to technology was increasing dramatically and very, very, very fast. This is a small town outside of the capital of Naypyidaw. That's a market, and we were walking around the market and found folks all over the place that had smartphones, basic smartphones like this one, to access the internet. So what we were asking people the whole time we were there is, when we go back to the United States, what message do you want us to convey? What do you want us to tell people back in the United States? What do you want us to tell politicians, companies, things like that? And we thought, because of all of these crazy things, there's probably gonna be some important things people want to come back. But do you know what the most common response we got was? When will the Myanmar language, which is the language of Burma, be available in Microsoft Office? That was the most common thing we heard. And personally, I never would have thought that would have been the number one request. Never would have thought it. And perhaps that's due to my own personal bias or my own lack of experience. But since I went there, I've been sharing this story with a lot of folks, especially folks in the technology community and people building anti-censorship tools and circumvention tools. And they were surprised, much like I was. And that made me think, if a response like this is so surprising, what does that mean for how we approach and understand the needs of users around the world when we're trying to build tools to help them, right? It really made me think a lot about that. And by the way, if you want to know more about our trip there, you can go to this link and read the full report. So what I want to talk about today is a project that we're doing called a user-focused approach to guiding the development and impact of Internet Freedom Tools. I want to share briefly a little bit more about who the Open Technology Fund is, which is a Radio Free Asia program funding this work. Talk a little bit more about Second Muse, my organization, and why we're involved. I want to explain our process and share some of the emerging learnings because, and I'm going to say this multiple times, we are in the early stages of this project. This is not a finished project. This is a progress talk. And I want to invite you to participate because the main reason I'm here talking to all of you today is because we want to solicit more feedback from others about what we're learning so far and how we can do something that is meaningful and impactful to this space and additive to it rather than is yet another burden or another point of view that's just thrown in the mix. So how are Internet Freedom Tools developed? There's a couple of approaches I want to talk about. One approach is this. I'm a developer, and I see a technical threat to privacy or security. I'm going to develop a tool to address this threat, and others who have the same threat can then adopt this tool and use it as well. Now, this approach is not wrong. I think this is a common approach. I think there's good reasons for it, but I do think oftentimes it can be incomplete. Here's another approach. I'm a developer or I'm a designer, and I've studied and assessed the privacy and security needs of a user community. I've built a tool for the community which addresses those needs specifically. I will examine other communities and translate this tool if they have similar privacy and security needs. Now that sounds nice, this is kind of maybe the other end of the spectrum, but that doesn't sound very realistic to me, that every time we're going to build a tool, we're going to do this big comprehensive study and understand everything that's going on and then design a tool for them. But I think there's value to both approaches, and what I want to know, is there a way that we can resolve these approaches? Is there a way that we can resolve the technical approach with the human-centered approach and kind of bring them both to bear in this space? What we're finding is that, so this approach of looking at kind of both sides of the coin is something that's seen a lot of success in all kinds of industries and all other sectors. But what we're finding in this space is that if you are a developer, you are a designer of tools, and you want to embrace more user-centric approaches to developing your tool, there's not a whole lot of support out there for you. There's nothing out there that we've been able to find that says, this is how you apply a human-centered design approach to building an Internet Freedom tool, toward building a privacy tool. And we want to remedy this, hopefully, by building some of that support so that more of that can be ingested into the development process of many tools. So before I go any further, I've already used a bunch of phrases that I want to define formally before we go forward. And I'm defining these not to say that these are the definitions, but that these are the definitions we've chosen to use for this work, so that when I'm talking about these things, you know that what I mean by them. So the first term is Internet Freedom Tool. I've thrown this around a bunch. The definition of Internet Freedom Tool, actually defined by the funder of this work, the Open Technology Fund, are technologies that circumvent repressive censorship and surveillance, or increase communication access and safety. Now, there's many tools that fit this bill, whether you consider them an Internet Freedom Tool or not. For the purposes of this work, if they fit the bill, we'll consider them as an Internet Freedom Tool. That might be Tor, it might be OTR, it might be Redphone, or CryptoCat, or PGP. When we talk about user communities, that can mean a lot of things. In this work, we mean it as a group of users or potential users of Internet Freedom Tools that can be defined by geography, culture, shared experiences, or a shared set of challenges. And then I'll also be throwing around a couple of terms a bunch, which I'll go into more detail about later. And one of those is ethnography. Ethnography is the study of culture and human motivation through qualitative research. Now, the difference between qualitative research and quantitative research, very generally, is that qualitative research is essentially more subjective, which has a bunch of benefits and also some drawbacks. With subjective research, you can really get some amazingly deep insights. but you also run the risk of bias in a lot of ways. And then ethnography is captured under a broader umbrella of something called human-centered design. And human-centered design is really the belief that if you take an empathy-based approach to understanding the motivations and the goals of people, you can do a better job of understanding their needs. So through this project, what we're trying to do is, number one, understand the Internet Freedom Tool development process, understand the context under which users employ those tools, and understand how the needs of users can better inform the creation and deployment of these tools. And we really want to do two basic things with this. Number one, we want to create a framework of some sort that will increase the ability of developers to make better tools that address the needs of users more explicitly. And number two, we want to find more intersections between developers, users, funders, and intermediaries so they can collaborate and work together in creating more robust tools. And I'll talk about why that's important in a minute. So there's a few major steps to this, and I'm going to go through these in this talk. First of all, we're conducting a really thorough landscape analysis of the whole space, trying to understand what's going on in the space, what the needs are. Essentially, take our own medicine first before we act. We're going to develop a research-based approach grounded in ethnography and human-centered design. So taking what we've learned, applying it to developing the research questions that we want to find out so we can assess the needs of users. Conduct an actual on-the-ground study with real users or potential users with a clear threat model. Understand their needs. And then take what we've learned and create some sort of draft pilot framework that kind of lends support to that approach I was talking about before, that says, here are some things that you can do as a developer. Now, note that I put an asterisk next to framework. I think framework can mean a lot of things. And honestly, at this point, you know, we're saying the output of this work is going to be a framework that we say, here's something that's helpful to you, hopefully, as a designer or developer of tools. I don't want to presuppose what that will be yet. Sure, it might be a report. It also might be a series of instruments and tools. It also might be a ton of surveys and step-by-step analyses for how to take the results of those surveys and turn them into actionable milestones in your development roadmap. We're still figuring that out. We're going to be working on this project through the spring. And I want your feedback on what will be valuable to you once I've talked a bit more about everything we're doing here. So before I go back into kind of what this project's all about, who are these organizations? Well, first, the Open Technology Fund, which is, we are really thankful, is funding this work. The Open Technology Fund exists to advance the research, development, and implementation of Internet Freedom Tools. It's a program that is part of Radio Free Asia, which I described earlier. And they've done a lot of really amazing work. They've funded a lot of great stuff in this space, projects like Tor, Global Leaks, Whisper Systems. I mean, you name it, they've been involved in some way. And they're really pushing the envelope, I think, in this space in terms of a funder in this space by funding, let's say, riskier projects, because I think funding is a big challenge in this space, and they're there to try and start up some new ideas that maybe haven't gotten attention yet. And Second Muse is my organization. So at Second Muse, we work to improve the world through technology and collaboration. What does this actually mean? Well, I work with a group called the Open Innovation Group. And we design and execute programs that source innovative thinking all around the world to solve complex social challenges. One of the programs that we've run for a number of years, some of you may know, it's a program called Random Hacks of Kindness. And this is an earlier project that we did for a while that really said, hey, maybe we can get a bunch of developers and technologists around the world to decide for themselves what's important in their communities and build something relevant to them. Now, since then, we've done a lot of other projects. We ran NASA's International Space App Challenge, which looked at how you can apply open innovation towards space exploration. And then we ran a project called the Central America Domestic Violence Hackathon, where we worked with nonprofits and NGOs throughout Central America. We said, let's look at the space of problems within domestic violence in Central America. Let's identify a subset of those problems that could potentially be solved by technology. And let's build and convene communities of technologists to prototype solutions to some of those problems. And then ultimately, let's incubate the really, really good ideas into lasting projects that could actually be implemented and used in the real world. Now, I could give a whole talk about that. I won't. But I want to say that this was an interesting one because, unlike the first two projects, the privacy and security implications for doing open innovation in the space of domestic violence start to become really clear. And you realize, wow, you can't just have people innovating on this. You have to actually give people a way to do it safely, securely, freely, openly. So really what we realize is we believe that free speech and free communication is a fundamental ingredient of open innovation. If you're gonna come up with innovative ideas, you're often gonna be disrupting the established order, and that established order has a reason to try and shut down your way of coming up with those new ideas. So how can we help empower open innovation, especially through technology? And we believe that's by supporting the research and development of more effective tools that enable people to access the internet freely and communicate freely. So that's really what led into this project. And I just want to give a shout out to my team. They're not here today, but I couldn't do this without them. So my background, I have a PhD in computer science. I did my research in privacy and security. But to do this work properly, we need a diversity of backgrounds. And Katie Metzroth on the top right, she has a social science background and has really applied a lot of that work to social impact and socially sustainable businesses. Roxanne Stafford on the bottom left has a deep background in design thinking, taught at Stanford for a bit about that, and has done a lot of ethnographic work. And Nick Skitland recently joined Second Muse. We're really happy about that. He just came over here from NASA, where he was heading up their open innovation program. So the four of us have been working on this project a lot. I want to give you their faces too, because we want to talk to more people. And so now maybe you'll know who they are when they come and say, hey, can you talk to me for a minute about what you're doing? Okay, so back to the project. I'm going to talk about the three phases of our work. We're in the middle of the first phase right now. The first phase is the landscape analysis. Then we're going to do an on-the-ground research study in a place called Dharamshala in India, which I'll get to in a minute. And then we're actually going to figure out the best way to output all this stuff. So as I said before we do anything by saying, oh, this is what can be done in this space to build more effective internet freedom tools, we have to take our own medicine. We have to look at this space and say, where are people in the space at? Where are developers at? Where are funders at? Where are intermediaries and users at? Can we understand the landscape of the space before we start deciding how to act within it? And that's what we've been spending a lot of time doing over the past couple of months. Our main mechanism for doing this is through interviewing experts representing a diversity of roles in the space. And we've interviewed about 20 people at this point. And if 20 people doesn't sound like a lot, I assure you when you're doing comprehensive interviews, it is. It takes a lot of prep and a lot of post-work out of every single interview to make sure you're coming up with an approach for that person that makes sense and you're making the most of your time with them. And then distilling all the learning and comparing that learning to the other folks who you've been interviewing. So what do these interviews look like? Well, these are just a few example questions. We actually have this giant template that we custom tailor to every person, but here are some different questions that we might ask either everyone or developers or intermediaries or users. By the way, I've been throwing intermediaries around a lot. I just wanted to define that really quickly. In this context, an intermediary would be an individual or a group or an organization that acts as a middle person between users on the ground and developers of tools. So that could be a research institution, it could be an activist group, it could be a training organization. So, and it could even be a funder. So you might ask a developer, how are you identifying the needs of your end users and how do they currently affect the development process? Because we want to know the state of things right now. We don't want to come in with assumptions about how people are already doing this. And we've already found a wide range of some people take feedback in these different ways, some people don't. Intermediaries, you might ask. When you're working with users to identify tools that are most effective to them, and they have a threat model that they're working with, do you validate that threat? And if so, how? And for users, you might even ask very simple questions around, walk us through something that you're doing today, or what are the concerns that come to the top of your mind when you're using the internet? Because that might tell you a lot about their current state of education and understanding about what they're trying to do. So what are we learning? And this is kind of the main points I want to bring up here. We're in this landscape analysis phase. We've done a really broad review. What are some of the things that were coming out of this? Now, some of these might be obvious. I think some of them less so. So the first one that came up are personas are underused. Let me first ask a question. Who here in the software development context, who here knows, thinks that feels like they have a good understanding of what a persona is and how it's used? Okay. So there's a bunch of hands up, but it's actually only about a third of the room. Maybe a little more than that. So for those who aren't familiar with personas are basically an archetype of a user, and a stereotypical user amongst a certain group. So you might have a persona for a journalist, And you might look at that persona, and when you're designing tools, you think about that persona, which defines the motivations, the education level, the threats, the concerns, the daily activities of an individual who is a journalist. Now, what we heard from folks is that generally, using personas to develop internet freedom tools, people are a little nervous of that because there's a big debate on the acceptable level of granularity of personas. How could you say that all journalists are the same and design a tool based on an archetype of a journalist when the threats that they have are very different in all different parts of the world? But what we found, and we've heard from a lot of people, is that actually the space can afford some more generalization regarding the creation and use of personas. That actually, maybe being overly concerned about not having granular enough personas prevents a systematic approach towards defining tools that can be used by a wide range of people in a group. A persona is not meant to define a tool to say this only this version of this person can use it. It's meant to give you a baseline, essentially. Here's a baseline of concerns that you're going to want to hit upon when you're designing a tool for a use of this group. Another thing, which probably is not a surprise to a lot of folks, but the internet freedom space of tool developers lacks a lot of definition. The interviewers we've talked to have pointed a lot to a lack of cohesion in the space as a barrier to collaboration, but that there is a desire for collaboration. And these are just quotes pulled straight from the interviews of things that different people have said. People have called it nascent, splintered, non-existent, undefined. And while these sound like they have a negative connotation, generally the people saying it weren't slamming the space. They were saying there's more things that we can be doing and more collaboration that we could be doing in order to build more robust and more effective tools. Another thing that came up a lot about this, and this maybe actually ties a little bit more into the previous slide, is that when we've been talking to developers, and we've asked multiple developers this question, we say, who do you design your tools for? Who do you think of when you're designing your tool? They often say, well, I think of myself. And that's not to point blame on developers at all. I think what it actually points to is a lack of support and resources for knowing who to develop for, right? If someone doesn't have a good understanding of the different types of users out there, it's very natural to design for yourself. It's actually something we all do every day. So our question is, how can we help bring more resources so that you don't feel like you only have to design for yourself, but you can have a good understanding of other users? Training of end users in internet freedom tools is an important part of this of the development of tools. It's important because that's where a lot of developers and experts get hands-on experience watching people use their tools. But what we've heard from multiple trainers is that the effectiveness of these trainings is not always clear because it's not measured thoroughly, and the anecdotal evidence is not always clear. We actually saw this for ourselves. It was a really interesting experience. My colleague Katie, who I mentioned earlier, went to an event where a bunch of, there were a bunch of journalists from Palestine that were invited to the US a few months ago. And she went to an event where a bunch of trainers and developers of tools hung out with these journalists for a few hours. And these journalists talked about all sorts of things, like, you know, I'm afraid of when I go over the border that people are going to take my laptop and take the data off of it. I know these stories about people getting thrown in jail for liking Facebook posts. All these serious concerns about privacy and security. And then for the next few hours, they worked with these trainers and developers to look at a suite of different tools and how those tools could affect and help them and where they are. And there came a certain point in this training where, despite the trainers' best efforts, and I think that these trainers knew a lot about what they're doing, and I really have a lot of respect for them, but despite their best efforts, you can tell that the journalists that were there were starting to get really visibly frustrated. They were overwhelmed, frankly. They were overwhelmed by all the things that they didn't know were problems. I mean, these are folks coming in that, you know, didn't even have were expressing concern about people stealing the information off their computer, but didn't even have a screen lock password on their computer. Right? So when they're presented with all this stuff, they got really overwhelmed. And at the end of this training event, at the end of this meeting, they went around the room, and to the 10 journalists in the room, they said, the final question is, after learning everything you have here today, what are your biggest security concerns? And despite everything that they said earlier, despite everything they've been talking about all day, 8 of the 10 journalists said, you know, actually, I don't really have any really major security concerns. And that was really interesting and really informative, right? About these folks came in with these clear things that were going on. And after going through the whole process of learning about everything that could go wrong and everything they could do to address it, they said, this is too much. Another learning we got, we've talked to a number of funders. This is a space that is reliant on the funding of a number of foundations and organizations. And there's not a lot of funding to go around. But funders do want to fund. We've heard that over and over again. They want to get involved in the space. They want to give you their money and say, do good things to help us with the people that we serve around the world. But they're currently treading carefully. And the reason why they're treading carefully is that they don't have the certainty that they want before making an investment. So here's an actual quote from a funder that we talked to. The elephant in the room is how well are on-the-ground activists going to use privacy or circumvention tools? They won't do it well unless they are trained or born digital activists. This is an illuminating quote for us and something we heard echoed, though not as concisely, from other folks, that there's skepticism about the effectiveness of people on the ground being able to effectively use these tools. And I think what's implicit in the sentence is they're saying they won't do it well unless they're trained or born digital activists, and the implicit statement in there that we've heard is that most folks are not those things. It's important to remember that funders are mission-driven, and to them, it's not clear yet what tools will help them achieve that mission. And another thing that we heard a lot is that communication between quote-unquote techies, something we heard techies, and non-technical funders is a challenge. So I think that's improving. There have been a lot of events that have been going on, especially this year, trying to bring together funders in the space with developers. But it's got a ways to go. And a couple more that I want to talk about. One, this is a really interesting theme that came up. When thinking about usability, is there a difference between use of a tool and usefulness of a tool? So when you're examining usability, maybe there is a really important difference there, and maybe we don't think about both sides of the coin. This is a quote from someone, a developer that we talked to, or a researcher that we talked to. This person said, for many, use is at top of mind when thinking about usability. Did the user click in the right place? Did they enter their password? Perhaps a better understanding is usefulness. And when we say usefulness, the questions might come up, not did the person click in the right place, but is this tool relevant to their daily activities? Does it help them achieve their mission? This is really combining, looking at use and usefulness separately, or bringing them both under the umbrella of usability, is a way of having a more holistic approach to usability. And this actually also ties into something else that we heard from a number of folks, which is the idea of a relevant tool versus an appropriate tool. The argument being that we heard from this person that we talked to, who's another person who's been involved in this space for a very long time, said that when you go to a user and say, this tool is appropriate for you, you should use this tool, you're baking in a lot of assumptions into what their realities are every day. Assumptions that you can't necessarily back up. But if you go to that person and say, from what I understand, here are a series of tools that are relevant to you, now let's work together to find the one that's most effective for you, you're coming in with less assumptions that you can have a more effective approach. Again, I want to stress that these are all emergent learnings, and if any of you have strong opinions about them one way or the other, I really want to hear from you. The reason why I'm sharing all this stuff here is not to say, these are the answers, this is what we've learned, period. It's to say, this is what we've heard so far, and we have a long way to go, but this is, you know, an opportunity to kind of try and share some of those ideas a little more broadly. And then finally, and this is, I think, probably the most important one, the value to developers. If we're going to propose more support to a user-centric approach that developers can use, it has to complement the work of developers, not just create more work for them. And we heard this from a lot of folks, and I think it's a really important point. People say, look, I don't have a lot of money, I don't have a lot of time, I don't have a lot of resources. I'm working really hard on making something that addresses a really important threat, and I don't need another box to check. And I think that's completely valid. And a really important point. In the end, if going through all this understanding of how you can better serve the needs of users, we're just coming up with a list of boxes, that's not going to help anybody. So we want to make sure that whatever we're learning and how we translate this into outcomes and outputs, it's something that is valuable to developers and designers of tools. So they say, yes, I want to implement this more. I see how this will be of value to me and my tool. So again, those are just a few of the learnings that we've kind of come up with so far. Now we're going through another series of deeper interviews to prepare for our next phase, which is our on-the-ground research. So as I mentioned, we're going to be spending a couple of weeks, our entire team is going to be spending a couple of weeks at the end of March in a place called Dharamshala in northern India. Dharamshala is where the Tibetan government in exile currently is based, the Central Tibetan Administration. So they're based there, and they run the daily affairs of the Tibetan government. The Dalai Lama is based there. There's also a variety of activists and journalists and other people based there. And we're going there to employ some different ethnographic methodologies to Dharamshala, India, and examine both the results of what we find in terms of the needs of the users and potential users on the ground, and also the effectiveness of the approaches that we're trying to see if they can work well in this space. So why are we going to Dharamshala to do this? Well, like I said, we want to spend time with users, real users or potential users or what have you. And this whole project is a pilot study. No one, to the best of our knowledge and all of our research, no one has done this yet in this space. So we want to go and test some of this stuff out on the ground. We're only going to go to one place because this is a pilot. We know that we're not going to create a robust outcome based on one place. We know that. But can we pick a place that gives us a good stepping stone? And we chose Dharamshala because, number one, there's a range of user groups there. There are journalists there. There are even developers that are often there. There are activist groups there. There's the Central Tibetan Administration, which is based there. Number two, there's a known threat model. The main surveillance threat for people in Dharamshala is the Chinese government. Now, I attended India's surveillance state talk yesterday, so maybe there's some other adversaries to consider there. But there is at least one known clear threat model that's validated and essentially verified. Now, the thing is, it's well-tread ground. We're going to go to one place and spend time there. We want to get as quickly as possible to working with users to try and identify and understand their needs. We don't want to have to find out that we've wasted a lot of our time on the ground trying to handle the logistical constraints and the relationship building that you need to do an effective study. A lot of tools have spent developers there. A lot of trainers have spent time on the ground there. I'm sure a lot of people at this conference, maybe people in this room, have spent time there. So that makes it a viable place to do this work. And finally, there's a really important interest here from Radio Free Asia. Radio Free Asia, again, is funding this work through the Open Technology Fund. And if we're going to do a study in one place, at the very least, out of all this work, at the very least, what we're doing is doing our own deeper needs assessment of the people in the place where this space and organizations in the space have decided they want to serve people. So even if in the end we don't translate things to a more broad set of recommendations that people can use all over the place, at the very, very least, we're going to be understanding more about Dharamshala and what the needs of individuals are there, and that will be translated and given over to everyone that tries to build tools for users that are based there. So what does it mean to take a human-centered design approach on the ground of Dharamshala? So I'm saying we're going there for a few weeks. What are we actually going to be doing? Well, as I said, ethnography is a study of culture and human motivation through a qualitative process. It really, ethnography complements usability studies, it complements different things by giving you the why behind people's actions. And following the path of identifying that why someone does something, can lead to innovative thinking and innovative solutions. So there are a lot of different ethnographic methods that can be applied. And these are just a few examples. And we're going to be testing a number of these out. One is interviews, which I talked a little bit about before, but I'm actually going to go into more detail on how you do those on the ground. Another one is shadowing. What is shadowing? It's very simple, actually. You spend an entire day with someone. You walk around with them the whole day. And you watch them and how they go about their daily activities. You know, one example, I think, this is a purely hypothetical example that's come up is, you know, if you're designing a tool for someone, right, for someone to use on their desktop, what you decide to do and how you design the interface for that tool, and even how you design different components of it, might vary a lot depending on whether or not that user is the only person that uses that computer, or whether they share it with only their family, or whether they're using it at an internet cafe. Right? Now, that's a pretty basic thing that you might be able to identify on your own. But there are nuances to those approaches that can really come out when you're spending quality time on the ground with someone, understanding what they're doing. Experience sharing. This might mean doing something as simple as giving someone, or it's also called a camera study. Actually, there are different things. So a camera study is something that people do a lot, where you actually give someone a recording device of some sort and say, go and record your day. Go and spend your day without us around and record the elements of it and then come back and we'll go through it together. Now, in this context, now that's a very, very, very common use of ethnographic approaches. In this context, they may not be possible at all. It depends entirely on the situation on the ground, what the threat scenario is, as to whether or not you can give someone a recording device and ask them to record what's going on in their day-to-day activities in a way that doesn't put them at risk. And this is part of our approach, is to understand what methodologies might work and might not work in the context of building better internet freedom tools. Experience sharing, get a bunch of people around and say, instead of them sharing their stories with you, have them share their stories with each other and observe that. Solution analysis, get people together and actually walk through the solutions that have been presented to them. And co-design, get people together and actually help them, work with them to design solutions that are effective for them. Now, in both solution analysis and co-design, that's not to suggest that if you get a bunch of users in the room and co-design a solution with them, they're going to come up with the right answer. And actually, this is an important concept that's throughout the entire thing. It's not the act of talking to a user and them telling you what they think that allows you to know what you do with your tool. It's experiencing, spending time with the user and hearing what they say combined with what they do and how they act and how they do it and who they talk to and what physical cues they give that allow you to interpret what their needs are. I'm sure many people who develop tools in this room have had this experience. A user comes to them and says, why doesn't this tool do X, Y, and Z? I want those features. And then you go and build those features, and you give it back to the user, and they never use them, right? That's common, because users often don't know what they want. And it's not due to any fault of their own. It's because it's hard to know what's needed. It's hard to know what you want. And if you spend time with them and look at more than just what they're telling you, you start to really can pull out some more interesting answers about what is needed for them. And this is something, again, that's been applied in many different places, in many different industries. So what might an interview look like? You're interviewing people on the ground. One important thing is you want to ask why when someone does something. You want to ask why they're doing that thing. And then you want to ask them again. And then you want to ask them again. When you ask why multiple times, you can really get to the core of a reasoning behind something. You want to encourage stories, and you want to look for inconsistencies. So it's not just about asking questions. It's about you hear something interesting, and you say, wait, tell me a story about the time that happened. And through those stories, you can start to pull out really interesting tidbits of information that can be much more informative than the original point that was being made. And inconsistencies and nonverbal cues can tell you a lot about what that person is really thinking or doing or what they really need. And then finally, and this is true with all this, you want to ask questions neutrally. You don't want to bring your bias into the approach of asking questions of people and trying to assess their needs. You want to approach it as neutrally as possible in as unbiased of a form as possible. So now what? Say we finish our on-the-ground study in the end of March. Now what do we do? Well, at that point, we have a lot of processing to do, a lot of analysis to do, and we want to understand and distill the meaning of what we drew out of it and come up with a few things. Number one, of course, a series of actionable takeaways for developers of internet freedom tools that are targeting user communities in Dharamshala. Number two, best practices on applying these different methodologies in general. Now, it's going to be hard to generalize based on one place, but if you qualified enough, I think this will give us a good starting point. And finally, instruments that can actually be employed by developers. And what do I mean by instruments? I think I mentioned this earlier, but it could be something as simple as, here's a survey that you should give to people in your target user communities. And here's what you do based on the responses that you get. So I'm running a bit low on time, so I want to skip to the end here. I'm going to come back to these links in a second, but really I have questions for all of you, which is, based on what you've heard here today, how might this affect your work? What's relevant to you? What's not relevant to you? A lot of you represent people who design, develop, create, and use these tools. Do you have stories like the ones that I shared earlier, or the one I'm about to share? Do you think all this is, could be useful in some way or not useful in some way? I'd really like to hear from you. There's a form that you can go to that's bit.ly/ift-feedback. You can go there and fill that out. You can also send me mail directly. If you don't want to fill out the form, it is a Google form. You can send me encrypted mail. That's fine. There's information about that on that page. So I would really love to hear from you either now or outside afterwards. I'll be around. So before I end, though, I just want to finish. I want to go back to Burma for a second and close out with another story. This is Motu Ong. Motu, when we were in Burma, we spent a week there. Motu is a reporter and a stringer for Radio Free Asia that spent his entire time there helping us get the job done. He was an amazing person, a really inspiring person, and he worked really hard for Radio Free Asia. Unfortunately, Motu passed away recently. He was in a motorcycle accident in Burma, and I'm really sad that I didn't get to see him. I did not get to see him after I left Burma. And I was hoping to see him sometime in the States or elsewhere in the world. But I'm bringing up Motu because Motu, he worked really hard. This is his desk at Radio Free Asia in Rangoon in Burma. He often slept behind that desk right there. He would sleep there multiple days a week. He worked incredibly long hours. He covered a lot of ethnic violence that was going on in different parts of Burma. He took his job very seriously and did it very, very well. When I think of users of Internet Freedom Tools, I think of Motu because he was operating in a country that, while now it's a little warmer to him, for a long time what he was doing there was illegal. This is his laptop. It was using an unpatched version of Windows and was also full of malware. If someone like Motu, who's doing really important work around the world, is in a state where he is not using or was not using tools that effectively protected him, I ultimately feel like that myself as a technologist and part of this community, that's not his failing, but that's part of my failing. And I want to make sure that we're building better tools to serve folks like Motu. Because while Motu is not around anymore, I know that there are many folks like Motu around the world doing this work and not being protected in the way that they should be. So that's really at the forefront of my mind when I'm doing this work. I hope this is helpful in some sense. And I think I have about 15 minutes left. I'd really love to answer any questions that you might have. I'd really love to hear your feedback and talk to anyone also afterwards. So thanks very much for taking time to listen.
Thank you very much for your talk. I think it's a very interesting and important topic, especially since I'm a psychologist and can understand this aspect of usability. Mm-hmm. If there are questions, please line up at the microphones. You first.
First, thank you very much for your very interesting speech. I think the methods that you've shown can be used everywhere in the world, at home as well, to build good applications. And as I had experience to support people in other countries, in other cultures, these ethnological part of your speech was very interesting for me, because sometimes you see that the people do not think the same about freedom that you think in relationship to your family, to your to women, to minority, to children, to everyone, to free speech and free mind. And so my question to you was, how difficult was it for you to implement to work your work when you saw that there were big differences to the things that you have in mind about these topics?
I think that's a great question. So the question, I believe, was, you know, not everyone has the same opinions of you about freedom or communication or access to technology, all these kinds of things. So how do we do this work when there are those differences? I think this comes back to a principle I talked about earlier, which is not only are you asking questions neutrally, you're asking them without bias. You want to do the best that you can to come into any situation and study any group of individuals or work with any group of individuals based on where they are at, not where you are at. You have to start with where they are at and work with them about what they need. So if ultimately what's identified is that they need something that is different from what you think they need, it doesn't matter what you think they need. It matters what they need and what you've pulled out of that analysis. So, you know, the short answer is you have to leave your own biases and your own opinions at the door when you go in. It's not easy to do, because it's your own opinions and biases that got you to that door in the first place. But you have to try.
Thank you.
Thanks for your talk. I think you pointed to some very important points, especially concerning privacy and security, because we all know that those problems cannot be solved individually. There needs to be widespread acceptance of those tools to solve the problems we're facing all over the world right now. So thanks for your work. But I think there's a little problematic assumption in what you presented in a process that is trying to solve this problem by building better tools alone, which in a sense assumes that you do all this work, which is great work, which is important work, and then you build a better tool, and then usability, which is a real important requirement, not only a pragmatic, but a political requirement, as far as I'm concerned, will solve this. But I don't think that any tool has an intrinsic use or intrinsic value built into it. And any tool can be used in different ways, which makes hacking available in the first place, or possible in the first place. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about whether you think or whether you should think that there needs to be a process of training of social and political activity based maybe on your research that accompanies the technical and tool development aspect of your work.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I completely agree. So the point and the question was, you know, tools alone aren't going to solve the problems that we face in the world. It's not just about building better tools. That's not the solution. And is there something else that should be done? Or maybe that's even more important than building more effective tools. Is that right? Is that an effective? Okay. And you're absolutely right. Tools aren't going to solve things. I think that what we're doing here is trying to bite off a piece of the problem. And the piece we're trying to bite off is, in the context of tools, how can they be built more effectively? Perhaps the more important things, and I would actually probably argue the more important things, are larger scale social and political changes that keep people safer, not ultimately tools. Even if you look within the space of internet freedom tools, we're focusing on a bit of that, which is the development of tools. Some of the things I pointed out and some of the things that we're uncovering, all kinds of other gaps within the space of how users interact safely on the internet, or even how developers interact with each other, or funders interact with each other, all these different things. This is not a puzzle that has a magic bullet, and I hope that we'll make a meaningful contribution to a piece of this puzzle, but I fully agree that it's only a piece of the puzzle, and that there are many other pieces that need to be solved.
Thank you.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for this interesting presentation. From my point of view, I would consider it as a key role, and also this project might be considered as a key project for solving the problems of citizens in countries which are under pressure, where the governmental authorities do not respect fundamental rights of individuals. And by resuming the presentations during the last days, from my personal point of view, I would consider there are four main topics, from my point of view, which I would consider as necessary for, I would say, the success of this project. First of all, you might guarantee your own independence, which means there should be a permanent communication between organizers, producers, the users as well, and the developers. And on the other hand, by doing this, you could also guarantee a kind of crowdfunding for the success, you know. On the other hand, regarding, I would say, the quality of your offers means there could be a kind of toolbox which is as flexible as possible on one hand, and could offer, on the other hand, as simple programs as necessary by respecting the educational level of the users.
Yeah.
And by doing that, I would say this could be a real brilliant solution for anybody, because this could guarantee the freedom of individual rights by using the internet and whatever.
Thanks, I appreciate that. I think that your point around the toolbox is part of what we're hoping to try and get to. Now, I'm not sure when I said framework, it could be interpreted as a toolbox, a guide, anything like this. And I think that, I want to make clear again that whatever form it ends up taking, we're not going to come up with the answer after this project. I think we really see this as a stepping stone that we hope everyone will be interested in iterating upon together. And that, if you look at even basic information about how to apply different kinds of need-finding techniques, it appears from everything we've learned so far would provide at least some value to the space, and so we feel good about that.
Thank you for the speech.
Sorry, he was first.
Sorry.
The most striking thing in the whole presentation was, when will Microsoft Office be available in Myanmar language? And as I'm totally not a native English speaker, and especially for those not of my generation, say my parents, that are both not completely proficient with the computer. So for example, they don't know that like in all Windows programs, the save command is in the first menu. The fact that they don't have a way to read the interface is extremely problematic because it completely stops them from using software in a productive way. The point is that we don't really, as the coders, I'm speaking here as a coder, we don't really need to translate the software ourselves. We can just provide internationalization hooks, and then anybody that is proficient in both languages can do the translation, and you can have normal users multiply your user base with no effort. And it takes no effort for the developer to do 80% of the internationalization job. And the localization can just be done by anybody else, and that will multiply your user base and your effectiveness.
Yeah. I think that's an important point about localization. I also want to use this opportunity to give a shout out to a great organization that we've talked to the bunch called OpenITP, who are doing a lot of localization efforts of different internet freedom tools. And yes, language localization is an incredibly important part of this work, and it's not just about a machine translation of one word to the other. Another interesting thing that has been coming up more and more is that it's not just about language translation, but also cultural translation, right? Understanding the context in which someone's using the tool in their own culture, it becomes more than just, I mean, on a simple level, that might mean the swapping of buttons, the yes and the no buttons, because that's the norm in one place or another, but it can go even much deeper than that. And that kind of localization effort is really important to all tools. Thanks.
Now, thank you for your speech. I have a question because you said that the people there want to know when their language comes out in MS Office, and you said you want to address their thoughts, what is most important. And then I have another question. Did you actually try to talk to them about different approaches, that maybe there are more important things, or did you just focus on what they want?
Yeah, I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because you identified something I was hoping someone would identify, which is, I said a lot during the presentation, you can't just rely on what someone says they need, you have to examine deeply what they need. So I want to make a point that when people said, when will the Myanmar language come to Microsoft Office, that's the most important thing to me, I didn't mean to infer that is therefore what we should do. But what I was trying to illustrate was that the fact that they would even say that is surprising to me, and I think many of us, says something about how we are able to understand and empathize with the needs of users. So that was a signal to me, not the signal not being this is the most, which I mean it might be the most important thing. You know, I don't know. I don't want to go there yet, because we didn't do this work in Burma. That was a precursor to this. That was just something that we learned. But the most important point is not that they said that, but the fact that myself and people I talked to were surprised by it, right? I think if we better understood and empathized with the needs of users, at the very least, we wouldn't have been surprised when they said that. So,
thank you.
I was thinking of two approaches, and I would like to know if you considered these as well. One would be like copying or like building substitutes for products they already use for tools, but making them secure, like collaboration stuff. I don't know if it's like a prevention of like censorship, but if you build like stuff into the collaboration tool already. So I think that's not quite as creative as the approach you mentioned, but then on the other hand, someone else had done the analysis of like what people need, and Yeah, and you got a big study if you consider that, so people, you know what people need and what functionality they need.
Yeah, that's a great point. So the question was, have you thought about looking at tools that people already use and trying to make them more secure? I think that is a very viable and valuable approach, and it's something even we heard in our interviews, which is to say that, you know, if you're going to build an effective tool, it has to fit in with a user's daily process. Like, there, no one ever, I think it's probably, this is a common term, but like, no one's goal on the internet, no one comes on the internet to be secure. You come on the internet to email your mom, or chat with your friend, or go to this website. You don't, like, your goal isn't to be secure, or to have proper privacy protections. So an effective way to build those things in is to have it be a seamless part of a user's experience. Now, that's maybe not always possible, but I think it's an important thing to strive for, and I think you hit upon a good point there.
Thank you.
Things that you came up with, that people going to the web to share things and they want to make it safe. So because maybe I don't get the whole idea of internet freedom tools, because like when people also in Burma wants to go there to share safely informations together, which brings me to the, like, there's two things, like the city of Munich, they wanted to change to open source. And all the average city worker was used to Microsoft Office. And when they changed to open source, the problem was not the backbone. The problem was the people saying like, oh, it was control F. Now I have to do control D with open office. I cannot get used to this. Everything is so different now. You know, so people are getting stuck with proprietary learnings when they use Office, MS Office, and suddenly something comes up which is a little bit different, and maybe it's a little bit more safe, but they have to do Control F instead of Control D now, or whatever, and they don't like it because they learned it like this. And another thing is with OpenStreetMap, you know. There were discussion wars in Germany how to stop using Google Street Map and all that stuff. The best way to do that would be to give 50,000 euros by the government to the OSM community to make the surface, the usability of OpenStreetMap even more smoother and make it closer to what commercial map providers doing, because they do it for all the DAOs, the noobs out there who have no clue. And so the idea is, I don't know how you want to do what you want to do, because therefore you need a sustainable developer community which is not easy to organize collaboratively. Even something like Ubuntu or Wikipedia, like the successful stories of an ongoing collaborative online work, is very difficult to sustain. So we need money for that, and we need collaborative, sustainable environments. Mm-hmm. And I don't see how the work you want to do will lead to overcome the main problem, which is that people are becoming lazy when they want to use the web.
I appreciate your point. I'm not sure that I agree that the main problem is that people are becoming lazy when they use the web. I think there's lots of challenges here. I do think that you bring up a really good point, which is, you know, all these software tools face a variety of challenges, whether they're funding challenges, resource challenges, sustainable development communities, right? I think that there are a lot of tools out there that have those things set. I think there are new ones being built that have the potential for that. And I think, again, that this is one part of the puzzle, an important part of the puzzle. There are many other important parts of the puzzle, whether that be, you know, the usability decisions you might make in terms of how close something should be to the related proprietary solution if you're creating an open source solution, or part of the puzzle being, how am I going to fund this tool that I'm not like I can sell it, so how am I going to fund the ongoing development of it? So I think it's important to recognize, even in this work, that there are many other ingredients to make something successful and to make more effective and more usable tools, and I hope this will be a valuable contribution to that.
Thank you. Okay, very last question.
Okay, thank you. Thanks again for your interesting talk. You made, I think, a lot of good points, like, for example, usability statements. You made also interesting points about, like, landscape analysis and stakeholder analysis. And I see a lot of parallels with solution methods we use in the industry to design, like, let's say, normal business solutions. And maybe you can give us 2 points where there are definitely parallels between solution design methodologies for IFT tools compared to business solutions, and where are no parallels or contrasts, where you say the solution we are using in industry and the experience we made in the industry are not the same for between IFT and industry solutions.
Right. So the point was that, you know, it seems like there's a lot of similarities here between some of the things that we're working on and how products are often developed in industry. I think that's 100% correct. That's absolutely correct. And what we're doing here is, you know, none of the stuff that I'm talking about is stuff that we've invented. I think we're borrowing from successes that we see in industry and in other industries, not even just software development industry. So I think that's a really good point. To answer your specific question, I think an example of the way things are done in industry a lot of times, that could be valuable here, is user focus groups, spending time shadowing users, spending time with them, doing in-depth interviews with them. These are all common things in industry to understand the needs to then develop a product that addresses those needs. As for what doesn't work, I think we're going to uncover some of that. One of the things that I suggested before is a common thing of industry is all sorts of recording processes that happen when you're studying users. You want to record their interactions, their faces. You want to record how they're interacting with something. That may not always be possible in this case, right? It may be possible if you're studying someone in the context of a safe environment, or if that person doesn't feel like there's an individual threat against them. But by and large, if you're using an internet freedom tool, it's because you're concerned about some threat that often relates to whether or not you can be identified. So if that's a concern, notice that even in the photos I had of Burma, no one's faces were in them. Not because they've specifically expressed to me, don't put my face in this, but because it's a legitimate risk. So I think finding what methods maybe won't translate effectively is going to be an important part of this work.
Okay. Thank you. A big applause for Michael.
Thanks, everyone.